Underworld. Disc 11.
Eleanor was just out of the shower when Marvin walked in, collapsing the room with his mood. She stood in a towel, pink-toed, and looked at him.
The ship came in. Lucky Argus. Pier 7. Exactly when they said, to the minute.
But Wainwright? She said.
Not on board.
Stand up straight.
Jumped ship in Vancouver.
Do they know where he went?
Signed on to some other ship. Going north somewhere. He's a cold-weather person, this Chucky.
You'll find him.
It doesn't matter.
Actually, it does. I used to think you were mad. But I understand now. Yes, you're mad, but there's a certain reasoning behind it. There's a little childlike spot of logic, a little bedtime thing. You need to finish the story.
Dear Marvin,
without the final link to the baseball, there's no way to be sure how the story ends. What good's a story without an ending? Although I suppose in this case it's not the ending we need, but the beginning.
He liked her in a towel. They'd first met near the end of the war. Said hello, goodbye, but corresponded. She was an air raid warden with a torch, they called it, and he was a quartermaster handing out condoms for D-Day that the troops fixed to the muzzles of their rifles to keep out sand and water. And he still liked her in a towel or slip, married 27 years to this point. He sat in his shorts at the edge of the bed, taking off his ribbed socks. They would do like tourists in commercials, have marital sex in a nice hotel. Their room had a view of a view. From their window, they could look across the courtyard to office towers and reflected clouds in the picture window of the hotel restaurant.
Marvin, do you plan to wear it?
She was talking about his toupee. I need it for how I see myself.
He also needed it because it took the edge off his large ears and sorrowful Marvin nose. He wanted it to look nice for her, even if she didn't think it mattered.
Tonight he'd wear his best shirt, with cuffs so French he wanted to hum the, what do you call?
You're my man, with or without.
A thing she said, with a half-fake quiver of her mouth that made him feel he owned the earth.
She slipped off the towel and placed a knee on the end of the bed. They were honeymooners still, shy but eager. And Marvin, in his Brooklyn-bornness, his religion of skeptical response, he was only now beginning to see how hard it was to persist in the sentimental myth, after all these years, of their dissimilarity, a thing he'd fabricated out of her accent and complexion. He was glimpsing his Eleanor truth by truth, that she matched him in appetite, that her ambitions for the business were bigger than his own, that her main ambition was America. A fact he'd managed to miss. The things, the places, the bright buzz of products on the shelves, the sunblast of fortune's favor. Here they were in a strange bed in California. What twists to life. How uncertain go the turns. An English girl in his arms, pink and innocent even if she's not, and Marvin's palmerized hairpiece secure on his head. She wanted Japanese, but that wasn't enough. They had to go to a place where the guidebook said tatami seating. Marvin thought if he lived all his life for 100 years before meeting Eleanor, he would have done the same 3 or 4 things in the same order every day. And as soon as he met Eleanor, at the age of 101, he would be sitting on the floor to eat seaweed. They faced each other over the low table in their stocking feet.
What's a word for the thing that's not ultimate, but next to ultimate?
Penultimate.
Penultimate, see? That's what I got in Chucky Wainwright.
Sit up straight, she told him.
Greenland. I always had my suspicions about that place.
What do you mean?
That's where he was stationed in the Air Force, if he was actually there.
Why wouldn't he have been there?
Do you personally know anybody who's ever been there?
No, I don't,
Eleanor said. Let me advise you, neither do I, and neither does anyone I've talked to lately.
I think there's a main city.
You think there's a main city? Do you know the name of this place?
No, I don't.
Did you ever look at Greenland on a map?
I guess I have, once or twice, perhaps.
Did you ever notice that it's never the same size on any two maps? The size of Greenland changes map to map. It also changes year to year.
It's large, she said.
It's very large. It's enormous. But sometimes it's a little less enormous, depending on which map you're looking at.
I believe it's the largest island in the world.
The largest island in the world, Marvin said. But you don't know anyone who's ever been there. And the size keeps changing. What's more, listen to this. The location also changes. Because if you look closely at one map and then another, Greenland seems to move. It's in a slightly different part of the ocean. Which is the whole juxta of my argument.
What's your argument?
You asked, so I'll tell you. That the biggest secrets are staring us right in the face, and we don't see a thing.
What's the secret about Greenland?
First, does it exist? Second, why does it keep changing its size and its location? Third, why can't we find anyone who's personally been there? Fourth, didn't the B-52 crash about 10 years ago? That the facts were so hush-hush, we still don't know for sure if there were nuclear weapons aboard. He pronounced it nuclear.
You think Greenland has a secret function and a secret meaning. But then you think everything has a secret function and a secret meaning, she said.
The bigger the object, the easier it is to hide it. How do you get to Greenland? What boat do you take? Where do you find an airport that has a flight to this main city that nobody knows the name of and nobody has ever been to? And this is the main city. What about the outlying areas? The whole enormous island is one big outlying area. What color is it? Is it green? Iceland is green. Iceland's on TV. You can see the houses and the countryside. If Iceland is green, is Greenland white? I'm only asking because nobody else is asking. I have no personal stake in this place. But I watch the Nature Channel, and I see tribes, they wear mud on their body in New Guinea, and I see those thingabeasts, they're mating in some valley in Africa.
Wildebeests, Eleanor said.
But I never hear a peep from Greenland.
The waitress brought sake for her, beer for him. She called the drinks beverages, and Marvin thought he was on an airliner. All the traveling he'd done, baseball-related, the unsheveled lives, the words and sentences. Wait-listed passenger Lundy, please present yourself at the podium. One, the mother of twins in what's that town? Two, the man who lived in a community of chemically sensitive people. They wore white cotton shifts and hung their mail on clotheslines. Three, the woman named Bliss, which he was younger than, Marvin was, and maybe could have, with eyes as nice as hers, done a little something in Indianola, Mississippi. Four, the shock of lives unlike your own. Happy, healthy, lonely, lost. The 1/8 Indian, lives that are blunt and unforeseen even when they're ordinary. Five, who knew a Susan somebody who spoke about a baseball with a famous past. Marvin forgets the tribe. Six, stomach acting up again. Seven, the chemically sensitive man, his whole body vibrated when somebody snapped a photo a mile and a half away. Eight, and Chucky Wainwright gone to sea, leaving a woman and child behind, a hippie Christian cluster, barefoot with beads, and Marvin tracking him ship by ship. Nine, and the bone cancer kid in Utah, which his mother blamed the government. 10, Marvin often lost, setting out one day from Melbourne, Florida, and nearly ending up down under. 11, and the woman with the chipped tooth, a whole long story you shouldn't ask. 12, and the chemicals in the core of the ball that made the man run in place after breakfast every day. Tell me what we're doing after dinner.
Me, you're asking?
You've been to this city before. I haven't, she said.
What's left to do by the time I pick myself off the floor? I've got a knot in my leg. A cannibal would spit it out.
Come on. Show me a good time.
She wants to go gallivanting.
Let's make this our city, Marv.
Strange how he was compiling a record of the object's recent forward motion while simultaneously tracking it backwards to the distant past. Sometimes he thought he was seeing the ball sort of fly by. He wanted to find Chucky and establish the last link, the first link, the connection to the polo grounds itself. But if he couldn't find the guy, he would probably buy the ball anyway. The reputed ball, once he located it, and keep looking for Chucky till he died.
I want you to show me the seamy underside, Eleanor said.
The ball brought no luck, good or bad. It was an object passing through. But it inspired people to tell him things, to entrust family secrets and unbreathable personal tales, emit heartful sobs onto his shoulder. Because they knew he was their, what, their medium of release. Their stories would be exalted, absorbed by something larger, the long, arching journey of the baseball itself, and his own cockeyed march through the decades. All right, Marvin was not a night person, but he knew one place he might take her. One street, really, that's all it was, called The Float, out near the old hippie district. Shops that came and went overnight, buildings without house numbers, an area catering to very select desires that changed with the phases of the moon. He lifted himself off the floor mat in stages, joint by joint, and they called a cab and went outside. 20 minutes later, they walked along the street, umbrellas up. It was raining lightly. A few panhandlers about. A woman in a mohawk and white makeup punching a doomsday leaflet into the belt buckle of Marvin's raincoat. Peace is coming. Be prepared. Most of the shops were open despite the hour, or because of the hour, and they were almost all below street level, so you peered over a guardrail to see what they were selling. Roll reversal rubber goods, or endangered fashions, jackets made from the skin of disappearing species. They went into a hole-in-the-wall place, a lot of cracked plaster and roachy baseboards, and a stock of rare recordings. But you're not talking about old jazz 45s. These were phone taps you could buy, or bugs in the wall, recordings of organized crime figures discussing their girlfriends or their lawyers. He's a hard-on with a briefcase. You're talking about men on the 11 o'clock news in cashmere overcoats with enough material you could clothe a Little League team from Taiwan. And phone taps of ordinary, anonymous men and women. Even more repellent, addictive. Your next-door neighbor, maybe. And Marvin understood how such a purchase could lead to stupefied hours of listening. Could take over a person's life, all the more so for the utter, suck-dry boredom of the recordings. And how they provided the lure of every addiction, which is losing yourself to time. The Float had an edge. It had a midnight finish. They stepped briefly into shops that sold autopsy photos, that sold movie stars' garbage, the actual stuff, deep frozen in a warehouse. You looked in a catalog and placed an order. Eleanor was delighted by the ambiance, a word she pronounced a little French. Bare board floors and stained walls. She took Marvin's arm, and they went down the street, spotting a sign in a first-floor window, Foot Fetish Cruise of Spanish Ports. Floating Zones of Desire. It was the, what, the dismantling of desire into 1,000 subspecialties, into spin-offs and narrowings, edgewise whispers of self. There was a dive with a back room where they showed sex movies involving people with missing limbs. They had gay nights and straight nights. If you were open to suggestion, you could float through the zone, finding out who you were by your attachments, slice by slice, tasting the deli specials of the street. You were defined by your fixation.
A boy walked by in clothes so raggedy he could have been a ticker tape parade. There was a place called the Conspiracy Theory Cafe. Shelves filled with books, film reels, sound tapes, official government reports in blue binders. Eleanor wanted to have a coffee and browse, but Marvin waved the place off, a series of sterile exercises. He believed the wellsprings were deeper and less detectable, deeper and shallower both. Look at billboards and matchbooks, trademarks on products, birthmarks on bodies. Look at the behavior of your pets. Something's staring you straight in the face. The largest shop was at street level. A dozen men standing around, furtive, in raincoats, looking at old copies of National Geographic. These were used magazines, used and handled, lived with, and the address labels were attached, machine-stamped and ink-smudged and skin-greasy, and printed on the labels were the names and addresses of real people out there in magazine America. And the men in raincoats stood by tables and bins and read the labels and leafed through the magazines, heads never lifting. A man bought a magazine and left quickly, slipping it under his coat. Marvin did not think these men were interested in photos of wolf packs on the tundra at sunset. It was something else they sought. A forgotten human murmur, maybe. A sense of families and little heartland houses with a spaniel flop-eared on the rug. A sense of snug innocence and the undiscovered world outside, the vast geographic. A pornography of nostalgia, maybe. Or was it something else completely? And was there a back room? Because isn't there always a back room, another splintering of desire? A little more refined and personalized? And in the back room, weren't the magazines cased in acetate folders? Maybe these were rare issues or rare labels. Or maybe the folders themselves were the fetish items here. Dust-veneered, handled, nearly opaque, some of them. A dullish sort of plastic with a faint odor and prophylactic feel, like condoms for reading matter. And maybe there's another room, where you need to whisper a password. And this is the room with folders only. Empty folders, handled 1,000 times. And Eleanor was completely creeped out by this place. It was more than she'd bargained for. Raincoated men with National Geographics, furtively thumbing the labels. Across the street they saw a tall woman's shop called Long Tall Sally. But not for dresses and coats. Fantasy enhancements, the sign read. Books, movies, appliances. Tall women only. You see a few funny things in some off-street on a rainy night, and you wonder why they seem significant. Marvin thought there was something here that might be an early sign of some great force beginning to tremble awake. He didn't know what exactly. He didn't know for good or ill. He didn't know where in the world. A shaking in the earth that could alter everything. All right, Marv. I'm ready to go to bed now. One more place. The one place on the street he'd been to before. Run by an acquaintance. You could call him a colleague. Tommy Chan. Maybe the country's first baseball memorabilist, if that's an actual word. They went down a grimy set of steps into a dark cubby stacked with scorecards and old songbooks and 1,000 other baseball oddities. Whole slews of records and documents in tottering columns. Eleanor sighed in her chest like a shot partridge. And there was Tommy in his high chair. The chair and cash register platformed, islanded higher than the surging mass of old paper that was going chemically brown. And it made Marvin think of all the game footage he'd seen during his search. Fans on the polo grounds throwing scorecards and newspapers onto the field as the day waned and the Dodgers approached their doom. All that twilight litter. Maybe some of it was sitting here today, preserved by the stadium sweepers and eventually entering the underground of memory and collection. Some kid's airplane scorecard, a few leaves of toilet tissue unfurled in jubilation from the upper deck, maybe autographed delicately by a player. The scatter of a ball game come to rest all these years later, a continent away. "This is my wife." "We don't see many women.
Tommy said, like a Buddhist monk in a backcountry compound, polite and wise.
"It's a wonder you see anybody, because frankly, who would come here?"
Marvin said.
"You have to make the place halfway presentable."
"Presentable. Nice word. Marvin, think. What am I selling here? I'm not selling housewares in a regional mall." He was a smart guy, and would be likable, but ageless in the face, which disconcerted Marvin because you like to know how old a man you're talking to.
"What did you sell today?"
"You're the first people in the shop."
"Don't look so smug."
"I've been here since noon. These other merchants don't open until very late."
"Since noon, and no one."
"How interesting to see a woman," Tommy said. Eleanor stood motionless, maybe part paralyzed by her exotic status. She said, "Don't you have to give people an incentive to buy?
Not that it's any of my..."
"An incentive? What a novel idea. The incentive is within, I think. These materials have no aesthetic interest. They're discolored and crumbling. Old paper, that's all it is. My customers come here largely for the clutter and mess. It's a history they feel they're part of."
Marvin said to Eleanor, "I always thought the people who preserved these old things, baseball things, I always thought they lived in the East. I thought this is where all the remembering is done. Tommy is the first collector I found anywhere west of Pittsburgh."
Tommy had a smile so slight and fleeting, it could only be photographed on film stock developed by NASA. His little knick-knack face floated in the gloom, and Marvin had a childlike urge to reach up and touch it, just to see if it felt like his, the rough, dull surface he washed and shaved every day.
"Did you find your man?" Tommy said.
"I found my ship. The man, forget about."
"You must give it up."
"Who's talking?"
"You can't precisely locate the past, Marvin. Give it up. Retire it. For your own good."
"Who's talking?"
"Free yourself," Tommy said.
"You sit here inhaling dust like what kind of statue?"
"Equestrian,"
Eleanor said.
"An equestrian statue in the park."
"True. My situation is even more unreal than yours. At least you move about. I sit here with my crumbling paper.
There's a poetic revenge in all this." "What revenge?"
A hummingbird's breath of a smile brushed across Tommy's lips. "The revenge of popular culture on those who take it too seriously." The remark had an impact. Marvin felt a thing in his chest like a Korean in pajamas who's crushing a brick with the striking surface of his hand. But then he thought, "How can I not be serious? What's not to be serious about? What could I take more seriously than this? And what's the point of waking up in the morning if you don't try to match the enormousness of the known forces in the world with something powerful in your own life?" He knew Eleanor wanted to leave. He knew Eleanor was thinking, "At least Marvin keeps the basement neat." There was something he had to buy first. A small, empty box, semi-discarded in a corner, marked Spalding Official National League Number 1. It once held a new baseball, many years ago. And he would save it for the time when the old, used, bruised ball came into his possession. If and when. He reached up to pay the man. Hung on the wall was a photograph of President Carter and his daughter, what's-her-name, standing in the Rose Garden with Bobby Thompson and Ralph Branca, a strange smile on every face. They went out to the street. A woman in rags pushed her belongings in a shopping cart, seemingly bent on a specific destination. Was there a family waiting? Was she a commuter of the future? Did people live, unknown to us, in the crawl spaces of the infrastructure, down the tunnels and under the bridge approaches?
"Tommy looks so happy. How is that possible, living in the dark?"
"Pick up your feet, Marv. You're healthy, not sick."
"Alone in that dungeon every day."
"Does he have a wife and children?"
I don't know. Who would ask? That's not a question we ask in the memorabilia field.
Does he enjoy the amenities, do you think, of our basic way of life?
You say that word terrific.
Does he have a little backyard where he grows Jersey tomatoes every summer?
I look at him, I don't think I see a tomato looking back.
Does he take his bride on business trips?
Eleanor knew how to make him feel lucky. And she was right. She was nearly always right. The tomatoes, the cleaning business, the house with the spacious basement, the daughter who hadn't caused them major aggravation by doing something stealthy out of wedlock. Think of Tommy eating Cambodian takeout in his shop at midnight. Think of Avram and Gorky walking down the hall with the kitchen tap every time he wanted to take a bath. They found a taxi idling in front of an old flophouse. But, in truth, let's be honest, it was Marvin who shuffled. Marvin who was the true schlamazel, bad-lucked in his own mind. Marvin the Dodger fan, doomed in ways he did not wish to name. A police car went by with its siren going, a rotary slurping noise. It sounded like the blender in their kitchen. She made fruit shakes compulsively that they felt morally bound to drink. Time to think about going to bed. But first, he took her dancing in the penthouse lounge of their hotel, an intimate room with a combo well past midnight. They moved across the floor, swayed and dipped. Not really dipped, but only showed a pause, a formal statement that such a thing as a dip could happen here. They liked to dance, were good together. Used to go dancing, but forgot. Let the habit slip away through the years, the way you forget a certain food you used to devour, like Charlotte Russe's when they were popular. She ran her hand through his fire-resistant hair, and Marvin held her close and felt the old disbelief of how they'd found a life together. Such fundamentally different people, even if they weren't. And he knew the force of this disbelief was the exact same thing, if you could measure it, as being stunned by love. But in the deep currents, in the Marvinness of his unnamed depths, there was still an obscure something that caused disquiet. And when they danced past the window, he looked out at the lights of the Bay Bridge spotting through the mist, and saw the old forlorn tanker snug in its berth, pungent and shunned. And he counted over to Pier 7, and found that the lucky Argus was already offloaded and gone, borne on the tide, a dark shape going at what? Flank speed, in the great, deep danger of night. Chapter 3. The club was not exactly jumping. There were 7 patrons, counting Sims and me, and 4 guys on the bandstand. A goateed sax and his hunchy sidemen. I didn't know where we were. It might have been Long Beach or Santa Monica, or some blurry suburban somewhere. This was the 3rd club we'd stopped at, and my scant sense of bearing lay in ruins. Big Sims wasn't talkative tonight, racing through the landscape with dark determination, half a drink and out the door, like a man assigned a task in an epic poem. "Hey, Sims, go home, okay? You're not enjoying the music. I don't want you to think..."
"The music's okay. It's music."
"But don't think you have to show me the sights. Go home. I'll stay a while and grab a cab."
"Go home."
"Go home, that's right. But first tell me who you're mad at."
"This isn't mad. If you think this is mad..." he said.
An elderly fellow brought our drinks, a guy with a wad of cotton in one nostril. He had a T-shirt that read Monday Night Football at Roy Early's Loins and Ribs. It wasn't Monday, and we weren't there. I said, "What happened?"
"What happened? What happens at home?"
"You had a fight with Greta."
"Forget it," he said. "Drink up."
"These guys ain't half bad."
"It's music. Drink up," he said.
Your stomach's knotted up.
"The fact is, we never fight."
"You never fight? Marion and I never fight. So, when it happens,
you retain it in the body.
You feel a knot, a weight.
We never friggin' fight.
We never fight, Marion and I. Go home and make up. I'll call a cab. Can I call a cab from here?
You're going a little gray, he said.
You're going a little bald.
I'm going a lot bald, but you're going a little gray.
The tenor was hitting cubist notes, and we'd had a number of half drinks, and the drummer was firing rim shots, or whatever they do. And in the local noise and the wider dislocation of a nightscape that was unfamiliar, I tried to understand what Sims was saying. Seriously, go home. I'm fine. I like these guys. It's hard-driving stuff.
It's race music, he said.
It's hard-driving, freewheeling jazz.
It's race music. You like it for what you want to like it for. I like it for what I want to like it for. I'll show you this picture I got at home. Great photograph, circa, I don't know, 1950s. Charlie Parker in a white suit in some club somewhere. Great, great, great picture.
A club in New York.
He gave me a flat-eyed look.
You know this?
Great picture, I said.
Wait, you know this? A club in New York?
He's wearing a white suit and those shoes I can never remember what they're called.
Out of nowhere, I thought about how our faces changed. How I tried to spy out a sign in another man's eye that would tell me how worried I ought to be. But at the same time, how I avoided eye contact until I'd had a chance to gain a certain purchase on the situation. And how we seemed to agree, together, as the room whistled and groaned, that if we all carried the same face, we would be free from any harm.
Can I call a cab from here?
Go home, make up with her.
Don't subject the episode to 10 hours of neurotic scrutiny.
Go home.
Go home.
What are those shoes called that I'm trying to think of?
Tell her you're sorry. Don't let it fester.
Old-fashioned two-tone shoes.
He looked at me, measuring.
We'll go to a ball game sometime. You're coming back in a few months, right? We'll go to a game.
I don't want to go to a game.
We'll go to a game, he said.
We drank up and left. In less than 15 minutes, we were in another club, listening to horn players rake the walls. Four guys in fezes and caftans with a physical sound, and a drummer who's making mostly vocal noise, off-pitch wails and cries. We ordered drinks and listened a while, and then Sims leaned in closer.
Happened to me twice since I've been out here. Pulled their guns. My life held in some cop's bent finger because I resemble a suspect, or my taillight's out. And he's out of the car, and he gets me out of the car. He says, I need you to get out of the car right now. And I get out of the car, and he says, I need you to hit the roof and spread him wide. But I just look at him, and he looks at me. We look at each other with a longing to kill that's completely puzzling in one sense, and completely natural in another.
I nod and wait. He sits very serious over his drink, Sims.
You want to be my friend. You have to listen to this, he said.
The walls were decorated with old Pacific Jazz album covers, and we turned our heads toward the bandstand and felt the force of the music, a sophisticated jazz that had the texture of life-and-death argument. I told him,
Yes,
I said.
Yes, I'm going a little gray.
But I don't understand why this is worse than all-out bald, which is your own admitted destiny.
That's the point.
What point? A little gray is not the most ominous thing that happens to a man.
Let's get rolling, okay?
Why?
There's a place.
I'm enjoying this place.
I'm showing you some things, okay? You have to accept this, he said. I'm here, you're not.
All right.
But you ought to go home. Tell her you're sorry. I want you to know something about us.
What?
We never fight.
We never fight either. Our friends fight.
That's why I'm twisted up inside.
I hear you talking.
Then let's roll, he said.
The next place was in downtown L.A.
Downtown L.A. The term had a secret life I couldn't clearly read. The group was between sets, and a haze of 10-year-old smoke hung over the room.
I played the horn. You know that? Still play? An old hawkshop horn. Threw it away, finally.
But you still have it.
Threw it away, he said.
But you kept it. You still have it.
Threw it away.
You didn't keep it?
What for? It sounded like hell.
Great thing to have. An old trumpet?
They're not called saddle shoes, by the way.
Those aren't the shoes I mean when I talk about two-tone shoes.
It sounded like the death and burial of music.
Jerk, you should have kept it.
Wait, I'm a jerk?
Great thing to have. You keep things like that. A second-hand horn? Great thing.
Wait. Big mistake, Sims. I'm a jerk?
The pianist came out first, then the bass. The drummer wore a headband and dark glasses.
The ship's back, he said. You know that?
No.
Up the coast in San Francisco.
Who tells you these things?
You know how rumors work. Nobody tells you, you just hear.
What do you hear about the cargo?
That's a whole other deal, Sim said, slipping into the forced air voice of a used car salesman, and a cracker at that, and a laugh shot out of me. That's real interesting. That's the sweetest deal about this whole bunch of rumors.
The horn finally showed, a rangy man with a gold chain and a gap in his front teeth, wearing resort clothes and sandals.
They said it was heroin. They said it was the CIA moving heroin to finance some covert operation. But we didn't believe this, you and I.
Because we're responsible men.
And we were right, Sim said. Because it's not heroin. It's not toxic chemicals. It's not industrial ash, and it's not heroin.
What is it?
It's a mix-up over a word. That's what it is.
Which word?
You know what heroin's called. It's called skag, it's called horse, it's called H, it's called smack, it's called this, it's called that. And what else, Nick?
Called shit.
See? It's not a boatload of heroin. It's a boatload of shit.
We were momentarily alert and uncircling. It was one of those episodes of heightened clarity in a night of talking and drinking. At one point, am I right, the rumor suggested it wasn't an ordinary cargo ship.
A sludge tanker. Turns out the rumor was correct.
Carrying treated human waste.
Port to port. It's nearly 2 years, he said.
We listened to the music, a cash register ringing at the end of the bar, and a trace of a radio voice, radio or TV, coming from a back room somewhere. Tell her you're sorry. Go home, Sims.
Maybe she ought to tell me.
Tell her first.
Maybe I'm not the guilty party. Ever think of that? The instigator.
Doesn't matter, you jerk.
That's the second time, he said, showing me two fingers.
We got out of there and went somewhere else. Zebra walls and small tables. A fairly crowded room with a body hum. People in aviator glasses and silver shirts.
He's wearing a white suit.
Right.
He's playing his alto.
Right.
And he's facing out of the picture, out of the frame.
And he's wearing white and brown shoes, two-tone shoes. But they're not saddle shoes.
I didn't ask what kind of shoes. I don't care about his shoes.
I'm just saying. I'm not interested in his shoes. They have a name I'm trying to think of.
Do it somewhere else.
In a club in New York, I said.
You know this? And I don't? And it's my photograph? In my house we're talking about?
The waiter brought drinks. Look, go home. Tell her you're sorry. Take a bath and go to bed. He looked at me, underlip jutting.
There's something else.
What's that? I said.
A judge issued an order. An injunction that they couldn't dump the sludge because there's a body buried there, Sim said.
And took a drink and pulled a cigar out of his pocket. Whose body?
Whose body? Whose body do you want it to be? That's whose body. Some mobster, I hear. Shot in the head, execution style.
A trio with a singer. She had streaky reddish hair and copper skin, holding the mic at her spangled thigh while the sidemen cued the next verse.
We never fight. Our friends fight, I said.
When the set ended, a fatigue passed over us, a staleness. Sims blew smoke past my shoulder. I jabbed an ice cube in my drink, poked it with a finger, and watched it bob.
This is man I knew once. I didn't know him. I met him once.
I was young, I said. He came around the pool room.
You're speaking in reference to what?
To the body in the sludge.
A mob figure. Who was he?
I was young, high school age. I only talked to him that one time. But my father had known him years earlier, which he told me about. Bottolato told me, not my father. They weren't friends, they were acquaintances. They might run into each other somewhere.
This is Mario you're talking about? Bottolato? Who I saw one time on TV, he said. When they're putting him in an unmarked car to take him to be arraigned, and some detective places a hand on his head to keep him from bumping his head on the doorframe. And I sit there thinking, why is it the police put so much effort into keeping these criminals from bumping their heads when they get into police cars? It's a major concern to the police lately, this hand on the head.
You're talkative all of a sudden.
He's always being photographed on the courthouse steps. He's the king of the steps.
You're right. Let's leave, I said.
Your father knew him?
This means what?
It means he knew him. In other words, I have to show respect. I have to be reverent when I mention his name. This guy who runs a criminal enterprise in narcotics, extortion, what else? Murder? Attempted murder? What else?
Waste carting, I said.
Could be. Why not? And I have to respect him, because he was nice to your father.
You're right. Let's leave, I said.
I didn't say I wanted to leave. I don't want to leave.
Tell her you're sorry and take a bath, I told him. Half an hour later, we were in the last club of the night, a blues room with an air of desperation, and the waiter resembled the old guy from two or three places ago, facially resembled. He wore a standard waiter's getup, but looked a lot, I thought, like the other guy in the football T-shirt three or four places ago, or whenever it was, the T-shirt and cotton nose plug. This place reminds me. You know how they're always saying, where were you when such and such? Where were you when Kennedy? Well, remember the time the lights went out? This place reminds me. The great Northeast blackout.
Am I supposed to ask where you were? He said.
30 million people affected.
I was in Germany. I never knew what caused it.
What caused it?
Nobody remembers. 30 million people. Not one of us remembers. But you remember where you were.
Ask me where I was. I was in a bar that was a little like this place, I said. Dead souls, sad jazz, palm trees painted on the wall.
This place doesn't have palm trees on the wall.
Even better, even more similar. And the lights went out.
They made a movie. I was in Germany, he said.
Maybe they didn't have jazz at this other place. Maybe they used to have jazz but stopped. They had a jazz policy that became a policy of no jazz, which is much the same thing if you examine it closely. He didn't resemble the old guy from three or four places ago. That's not who he resembled at all. He resembled the cab driver I'd hailed earlier in the day, or the day before. The guy who'd said, light up a Lucky. It's light up time. When they put me in the squad car, or maybe they called it a radio car then, it was a green and white vehicle, in any case. And the cop who drove was smoking, which he wasn't supposed to do. A uniformed cop on duty was not supposed to smoke. And it surprised me to see this, I remember. An officer cupping a smoke between his knees. Because I'd shot a man dead, and thought I was being taken into a system where the rules were consistent and strict. And the other thing I remember is that no one put a hand on my head and folded me into the car. Because evidently, this was not something they did at the time. This was something they developed later, preventing the felon from bumping his head when they took him in. This happened back east, of course. I've heard that term a lot since coming to this part of the country. But I never think of the term as a marker of geography. It's a reference to time, a statement about time, about all the densities of being and experience. It's time disguised. It's light-up time. Shifting, smoky time, tricked out as some locus of stable arrangement. When people use that term, they're talking about the way things used to be before they moved out here. The way the world used to be. Not just New Jersey or South Philly, or before their parents moved, or grandparents. And about the way things still exist in some private relativity theory, some smoky, shifting mind dimension. Or before the other men and women came this way. The ones in Conestoga wagons. A term we learned in grade school. A back east term. Stemming from the place where the wagons were made. The room was very nearly empty, and they were playing blues. "Be nice to her," I said. "Go home, talk to her, make nice. You know this phrase, make nice? They use this phrase when you were a Negro child in St. Louis, Sims?"
"They came to take the census."
"Yes. And what?"
"And my mother told me to hide."
"What for?"
"What for? That's the point. I didn't know what for. She thought... I don't know what she thought. I went and hid, you know. Two people at the door with clipboards. She said, 'Get inside, stay down.'"
"Stay down?"
"She said, stay down. I don't know what I thought, and I don't know what she thought."
"It was only the census."
"Don't say only the census."
"You tell me I'm going a little gray, and I'm supposed to understand how this is worse than total baldness?"
"Because it's in my history. It's in my family," he said. "I'm supposed to go bald. It's expected of me." "Stay down," she said.
"Stay down.
You believe the census, Nick?"
He sat there with his loosened tie and wrinkled jacket, relighting the discontinued cigar, a line of sundown pink visible above the jut of his lower lip. "What do you want me to say? Yes, I believe it. No, I don't believe it."
"I want you to say what you believe."
"Because I can sense we're about to enter some touchy area."
"What do you believe?" he said.
"I believe the census. Why shouldn't I believe it?" He gave me a flat-eyed look with a nice tightness to it.
"You believe it."
"Why shouldn't I believe it?"
"You believe the numbers. You believe there's only 25 million, for example, black people in America."
"Why shouldn't I believe it?"
"You believe it, then.
If that's the number, that's the number."
"And you don't think they might be underplaying the true number?"
"Wait a minute.
You don't think?"
Wait.
"Think about it," he said.
He plucked his shirt. He did a thing big men do. He used both hands to pluck his shirt away from his chest, and then he shook it, half dainty, letting his upper body breathe.
"Sims, you and I, just think about it.
We're not, remember, we don't have a word, you and I, for the science of dark forces, for what is behind an event. We don't accept the validity of this word or this science. Remember that conversation?"
"This is another conversation. And in this conversation, I'm saying, think about it."
"But you and I, we go against the tide, Sims. The tide is easy. It's irresponsible. We're responsible men. We've established this. We don't believe there are secret forces undermining our lives."
30 million people affected by your local blackout. But only 25 million, they're saying, black people in the whole huge country."
"If that's the number, that's the number."
"And this is all you can say. We have an issue that's crying out for, really, scrutiny. To use one of your words."
"Go ahead, scrutinize it."
"You're willing to accept this number?"
25 million. "Yes, why not?"
"You don't think this number is way too low?"
25 million's not so low. It's 25 million, I said.
"You don't think this number is totally underreported?" Why do you say scrutiny is my word?
Because you used it. This makes it my word? I didn't use it. You used it.
I believe the number. It's a believable number to me.
You don't think somebody's afraid that if the real number is reported, white people are going to go weak in the knees, and black people are going to get all pumped up with, hey, we ought to be getting more of this and more of that and more of the other.
You and I said.
You don't think the number is underinflated by maybe 40%?
We don't indulge ourselves in cheap and easy delusions, Sims.
Cheap and easy.
Am I right, you and I? We don't believe that what is behind an event is so organized and sinister that we have to make a science out of it.
You don't think white people are going to be so depressed, so, I hate to say it, menaced by the true number?
He didn't hate to say it at all. You think the Census Bureau is hiding 10 million black people? I said.
Not hiding the people. They're hiding the number. This is an easy thing to hide.
But a number so large, what a tremendous manipulation. And it's going on in front of our eyes. Maybe it's the mothers, I said. 10 million mothers telling their kids to stay down.
Stay down, I said.
A brief smile from Big Sims. A reflex smile, minus the ensuing brightness of eye.
Face the issue, he said.
What's the issue?
We have a right to know how many of us there are.
But you do know.
We don't know, because the number is too dangerous. How threatened do you feel by the real number? I'm talking to you. Think into your own heart.
All right, I'm thinking.
Tell me in your heart, you don't think there's something genuine in what I'm saying.
There's genuine paranoia. That's the only genuine anything I can see here.
He seemed to take pleasure in this. He sat back and looked off to the side, grimly happy, examining what there might be in the nature of human exchange that makes people so smoothly predictable. I listened to the blues trumpet, a young guy in a beat-up suit. He had an African blackness, you know, the saturate blacking of a bandwidth somewhere on the continent, some nomad swath of high desert grace and shape. But in gesture and stance, I saw the way he tongued some spittle off his lip between riffs, a body demotic that was locally made. He was another scuffling trumpet from an inner city somewhere. Charlie Parker, in a white suit in a club in New York, I said.
Now, how many references to New York have I heard from you tonight?
And I know what kind of shoes he's wearing.
I don't care what kind of shoes he's wearing.
Spectator shoes.
I don't care what kind of shoes he's wearing.
They're not saddle shoes. They're called spectator shoes.
I don't care what they're called.
Look, here's what you do, I told him. You go home, you say you're sorry. You put some fizzy stuff in your bathtub, and you take a bath and go to bed.
10 minutes later, we were standing outside the club, waiting for someone to bring the car around, and Sims put his hands on my shoulders and head-butted me. I didn't know how to take this. He gave me a tight grin and butted me high on the forehead. And I didn't know if this was an impulsive gesture at the end of a long night when you're muzzy with booze and hoarse with talk and smoke, a thing that brings an evening to a formal close, or something a little more deliberate. I pushed his arms away and butted him back, put my hands on his shoulders and butted him back, and he looked at me with interest and did it again.
It hurt, of course.
It set off a throb. It was a monosyllabic thing, a butt, a blow, a downward-driving shock that sent an electric pain through the back of the head and into the neck and shoulders. And it was up close, eyeball tight, a combat space without maneuvering room or finer points, a certain amount of acted rancor filling the visual field, a scowl and glare, or a hooded look, a sort of sleepy, killer thing, lidded and dumb. I was taller than Sims, but not so solid and volumed, and had never used my head as an instrument of medieval siege. I butted him just above the nose, driving down, and it stung him. I could tell. It sent a message unit ringing through his skull. He jolted me good. He hit me so hard I was stunned backwards, half stumbling, right out of his grip on my shoulders. and the guy showed up with the car and stood by to watch. The pain was electric and compact, reducing everything to its own sort of benumbment, making the world beyond my head seem small and dazed. This is what we did. We hairlined in, blocking out everything but the butting and glaring and pain. When he butted me again, I moved my head, eased back a quarter inch, trying to tone the blow a little, and he jutted his chin and glared. Pain is just another form of information. We knocked heads one more time, one time each, and the guy stood there with the car keys, watching. In my hotel room, I looked in the mirror above the wash basin. I put both hands to the wall and leaned into the mirror and saw bruises and welts, deep discolorations, and a slash of dried blood with a winy flush around it. I used cold water to clean the wounds, and then I went to bed. But I felt dizzy as soon as my head hit the pillow, and I had to sit in a chair for an hour before the feeling passed. The thing kept coming back to me, and I tried to get inside it. Inside the tremor. Our faces sort of double-framed over the ice cubes in our drinks, flying out of focus, then in again. Not to detail my own feelings, but only to understand the hidden triggers of experience, the little delves and swerves that make a state of being. We ran through smogged-out hollows past houses stilted over raw defiles, and we ran into wooded areas that had the look of tinder, a dry, white, dusty stillness, a sense of combustible edge, but maybe not. I might have been devising my own newsreel. What do you hear about the body in the sludge?
They won't find the body. The body's just another embellishment, he said. The main thing is the ship itself.
What about it?
A ship been on the high seas for 2 years, changing names and crews. That's just a story, too. The ship made one recent voyage, east coast to west coast, carrying sludge to California to deliver to a composting operation. Ordinary, simple shipment.
We ran along city streets, landscaped avenues of a certain fallen aura, an out-of-timeness that was ravishing in its open regret.
Look, Sims, here's the thing.
Let's run, he said.
I don't know, I'm a little... And I shouldn't say this, I know, to someone like you.
Love your kids, right?
Yes, of course.
Then run.
How close I am, some of the time, I sometimes think, as much as I love them all, to feeling like an imposter. Because it has not fucking ever been something I am comfortable with.
We stood in the kitchen, wasted by miles of hills and hot pavement, reluctant to move about for fear of dripping sweat on something. Two men in shorts, and Greta gave us glasses of water, a brown-haired woman with long hands and a half-hidden gauntness, a sort of lean and angular suchness, an X-ray Greta that probably showed itself in argument or stress.
"You like this place?" I said. "I think I am at the ends of the earth. 4 years we are here, and I am waking up every morning and trying to remember where I am. So far from everything."
"We are backed up," Sims said, "to a very big ocean."
And the son, the 5-year-old, sitting at the table with his cereal bowl and oversized spoon, Loyal Branson Biggs, a boy so softly handsome, so offhandedly blessed with expressive beauty, that I couldn't stop looking at him. I looked at him while I spoke to his parents, and they looked at him too. And they looked because I was looking, and I reminded them to renew their sense of amazement in the child.
"What happened to your face?"
Greta said to me. I looked at Loyal work his spoon through the lumpy milk.
"Well, this is a good question, actually."
"And what is the answer?" she said.
"Well, I had a little scuffle in the elevator. It's noticeable? At my hotel. I didn't know all the marks still showed. Two drunks, a white guy and a black guy."
I could feel Sims enjoy this in his hot Reeboks.
"Nick started the fight," he told her.
"This is true?"
She said it to me, but she was looking at the child eat his breakfast.
We were all looking at Loyal. They told him he was going a little gray, and he went berserk, Sim said.
Greta had to take the child to school, and then she had to go to her own school, where she taught chemistry 3 days a week with the ocean at her back. Sims and I stood on our spots, drinking water.
You two still mad? I said. She's still mad. I got over it.
I have a plane to catch, I told him.
He showered and dressed and took me to my hotel, and I hurried through a shower and got dressed and grabbed my bag and got back in the car, and there was a man on the freeway, a man on an embankment, nodding his head to drive-time radio, and he sat on the grass with an object across his knees, and Sim said it was a rifle, and I said it was a crutch, one of those metal crutches with a forearm brace, and it took me a couple of seconds to understand that Sims was kidding. This was just the language of the freeway. I found Southern California too interesting. The experimental aircraft, the fault systems, the inferno of cars and smog, the women from nowhere. Even the street gangs that were coming into prominence at the time, adopting varsity colors. I made business trips, but kept them brief and blinkered after the first one. The place had that edge-of-everything quality that creeps into innocuous remarks and becomes the vanguard of estranged feeling. When I shot George Manza, I began to understand the nature of this kind of feeling. They put me in a radio car with a cop who smoked, and they sent me eventually to a facility in upstate New York, a place that featured one of the oddities of the penal system. This was a miniature golf course, 9 holes, with cartoon turrets and windmills. We were youthful offenders, you see, and maybe the guidance counselors thought we'd take snug comfort in the nursery shapes and bright colors, or in the anal stuff of balls and holes. I don't know. I didn't know then, and I don't know now. But my mates and I, the D felonies and E felonies, the headbreakers, the thieves in the night, a mixed group, as you'd imagine, with races, creeds, cries in the dark. We used to amble past the windows in the mess and look at the layout down there with its loop-de-loops and tunnels and puddle lakes, its swards of tinsel grass, and we called it California. Phoenix was a neater package for me. I needed a private life. How could you have a private life in a place where all your isolated feelings are out in the open, where the tension in your heart, the thing you've been able to restrict to small closed rooms, is everywhere exposed to the whitish light and grown so large and firmly fixed that you can't separate it from the landscape and sky. I walked in the door and Marion said, "What happened to your face?" I walk in the door and this is what I hear. Children playing, radio playing, the news, the traffic, the phone is ringing. The washer is pumping through a cycle. I smiled and kissed her, and she picked up the phone. The kids were making noise out back, our kids and the neighbor's kids, a game made up by Lainey. I knew this from the quality of the shrieks. Lainey made up fiendish games, inventive, shrill spectacles of torture and humiliation. "What did you do to your hair?"
"Had it cut. You like?" she said, still on the phone with someone. "What happened to your face?"
I walk in the door and see light strike the cool walls and bring out the color in the carpets, the apricots and clarets, the amazing topaz golds. I told Marion the next night about the thing I'd done, or the night after that, the thing with Donna at Mojave Springs. I thought I had to tell her. I owed it to her. I told her for our sake, for the good of the marriage. She was in bed reading when I told her. I'd anguished about the right time to tell her, and then I told her suddenly, without immediate forethought. I didn't tell her what I'd said to Donna, or why Donna was at the hotel, and she didn't ask. I stood near the armchair with my shirt in my hand, and I thought she took it well. She understood it was an isolated thing with a stranger in a hotel, a brief episode. Finished forever. I told her I felt compelled to speak. I told her it was hard to speak about the matter, but not as hard as withholding the truth. And she nodded when I said this. I thought she took it fairly well. She didn't ask me to tell her anything more than I'd told her. There was an air of tact in the room, a sensitivity to feelings. I stood by the chair and waited for her to turn the page so I could get undressed and go to bed. The first available Saturday, the first Saturday I didn't go to the office, we drove south with the kids to see an ancient ruin. We had sunscreen and hats and drinking water, which was Marianne's idea, the water was, because this was desert scrub and the heat was intense. Lainey stood behind the front seat, sometimes elbowed forward between Marianne and me, leaning toward the windshield, quick to point out stupid maneuvers by other drivers. She reacted angrily to this, a habit that drained my own anger, and Marianne's too, and prompted us to make excuses for the stupid and dangerous moves she pointed out. Jeff was 2 years younger. He was 6, and liked to curl in a corner of the back seat, curl and twist, slide toward the floor in an astral separation from everything around him, using his body to daydream. Even if it wasn't a rifle, what was he doing on the freeway, on the grassy verge, sitting there with a metal crutch in his lap, just yards from that madman traffic? The ancient ruin was over 600 years old, a single major structure with smaller scattered remains and a trace of a wall somewhere. We stood in the late morning heat and listened to a park ranger for a few minutes before we drifted off one by one, although there was nothing else, essentially, to see. I read a plaque and then watched Jeff stalk a ground squirrel. He wasn't wearing his hat, but I didn't say anything. I just thought, tough shit, kid. Don't say we didn't warn you. Then I relented and called him over and gave him the car keys. The effort to relent, the effort to slacken and yield, to love him in his careless slouch, this was a brutally difficult thing to do. Small as it seems, small and fleeting, it was surprisingly hard. But I called him over and gave him the car keys. I knew he would like this idea, and told him to get his hat and lock the car and bring me the keys, and off he went, happy as I'd ever seen him. I drifted back to the main structure and stood among a dozen tourists and listened to the ranger talk, a heavy-set woman who scratched her elbow. No one knew the purpose of this structure, she told us, which was 3 stories high, with a faint trace of graffiti near the top. I found I was more interested in the protective canopy than I was in the ancient structure. The ranger said the building was abandoned about 100 years after it was built. The building and the whole settlement abandoned for no discernible reason. One of those mysteries of a whole people who disappear. But I found myself studying the protective canopy, with its great canted columns, maybe 70 feet tall, and the latticed framework that supported the roof. Lainey came and stood next to me, sort of collapsed against my haunch, in a way that meant she was irreversibly bored. The ranger listed some reasons why the people might have disappeared, the desert dwellers. She named flooding, she named drought, she named invasion. But these were only guesses, she said. No one had a clue to the real reason. I thought of Jesse Detweiler, the garbage archaeologist, and wondered if he might suggest that the people abandoned the settlement because they were pushed out by waste, because they had no room to live and breathe, surrounded by their own mounting garbage. And it was nice, in a way, to think it was true, one of those romantic desert mysteries, and the answer staring us in the face. I was becoming Sims-like too soon, seeing garbage everywhere, or reading it into a situation. I told Lainey to go find her brother and see what he'd done with the car keys. Then we started home like a ragged band of pilgrims who'd failed to see the statue weep. We were in the car 10 minutes when Marianne began to cry. She was at the wheel, and her face lit up, and she started crying softly. Lainey backed off from her standing station just behind us and took a seat by the window, hands folded in her lap. Jeff got interested in the scenery. I said, "Want me to drive?" And she shook her head no. I said, "Let me drive, I'll drive." And she gestured no, she preferred to drive. This is what she wanted.
We were on a back road flanked by saguaros and wildflowers, notched saguaros, pecked by birds that nested there. And then we reached the interstate and edged into the wind blast of streaming traffic. No last names, no echoing second thoughts. This is the pact of casual sex. But I told her my last name, and it wasn't casual, was it? That's the odd dominant of the piece, that I wanted to reach her, still her breathing, to make her breathless, yes. There was something about Donna that untongue-tied me. Guilt, later, feeling Marion next to me, asleep in the dark. When we disliked each other, usually after an evening out, driving home, feeling routinely sick of the other's face and voice, down to intonation, down to the sparest nuance of gesture, because you've seen it 1,000 times, and it tells you far too much for all its thrift, tells you everything, in fact, that's wrong. When we experienced this, Marion and I, we thought it was because we'd exhausted our meaning, the force that drives the alliance. Evenings out were a provocation, but we hadn't exhausted anything, really. There were things unspent and untold and left hanging, and this is where Marion felt denied. Marion, in her Big Ten town, raised safely, protected from the swarm of street life, and feeling deprived because of it. Privileged and deprived. An American sort of thing. All the scenes she recoiled from when she watched TV, the narrative of local crime. We see the body in the street, the lament of the relatives, the suspect doubled over to conceal himself. Marion couldn't even watch the detective's hand on the suspect's head, bending him into the unmarked car. It was all a violence, a damage to the spirit. But she wanted my stories, my things. The fiercer, the better. I was selfish about the past, selfish and protective. I didn't know how to bring Marion into those years. And I think silence is the condition you accept as the judgment on your crimes. She said it was her mother. She said it was 2 years ago today that her mother died, and I repeated it for the kids, and the kids relaxed a little. I reached back and got a stick of gum from Laney. 2 years ago today, and of course Marion knew this, and we didn't. I didn't. I hadn't kept track. And I felt relieved. And the kids did, too, because at least there was a reason. At least it wasn't a thing where the parents act funny and the children learn to make their faces blank. She shone brilliantly. She glowed in her weeping. She smiled, I think, a smile that was a wince, but also a real smile, with her mother in it somewhere. After a while, the kids started to sing, and I was relieved. I was goddamn glad, because I'd sat there thinking I was to blame. Or thinking maybe she does it all the time, because how the hell do I know what goes on when I'm not home? And the kids were singing, 99 bottles of beer on the wall, 99 bottles of beer. If one of the bottles should happen to fall, 98 bottles of beer on the wall. 98 bottles of beer on the wall, 98 bottles of beer. She looked at me, and looked at the road, and the kids kept singing, counting backwards all the way to 1, as Marion drove. Cried and drove.
This ends Disc 11.